Welcome to the Sufi Reverberations podcast, where each week, God willing, you will be able to hear a poem, a story, a meditation, and a musical interlude that give expression to one Sufi's perspective concerning the mystical dimension of Islam. My name is Anab Whitehouse, and I will be your host. Although I am not a sheikh, nonetheless, I did have the opportunity to spend 16 years in the company of a Sufi saint of the 20th century, and by the grace of God, was able to gain a few insights into the nature of the Sufi mystical path through that association. So, without further delay, let's proceed to the essential contents of this episode. The title of the following selection is Gratitude. Look into your soul and tell me what you see. Good mystery awaits us there, but our gaze passes through on its way to who knows where. Guidance arrives to illumine spiritual sight through pure prisms of saintly love, which shine like a lighthouse lamp seeking to warn of treacherous channels and signal safe passage. Yet we ignore everything without the seal of ego stamp, reaping what arrogance sows. We use the wind, stars, and currents, but the source from which they come goes unnoticed, while we speak of science and continue to play dumb. With a yawn, we greet the great purpose which governs all of life, while we navigate our fate. Hands reach out to beckon us, but like proud, blind beggars groping about, we lose our way home. Hope broadcasts its signs night and day, yet there seems to be a fierce interference in the air that drowns them out. Life slips away. Forgiveness rolls in like ocean waves ready to embrace our souls with cleansing grace, but is dashed on hearts of stone. Turned back by indifference, levies of defense against what? God only knows. Today's short story is entitled Poison and its antidote. The wealthy socialite was about to be hit with a nuclear explosion of considerable magnitude, one which couldn't readily be converted into tons of dynamite because the force would be emotional and spiritual rather than physical. Tired from a long day of politicking, making business deals, and attending various gala events, he had trudged wearily up the stairs to his bedroom. He had been looking forward to taking a hot shower and then collapsing into bed. Presumably, his wife had retired quite a few hours earlier, especially since she had not been feeling well. The door to the bedroom was closed, which, in and of itself, was out of the ordinary. Normally, his wife left the door open for him, except on those rare occasions when, for whatever reason, he went to sleep before she did. He quickly dismissed the anomaly and turned the knob. Door opened, revealing a darkened room. A sense of anxiety grabbed hold of the man's consciousness, and his stomach muscles tightened in response. Here was another oddity, for usually his wife kept the bathroom light on, with the bathroom door partially open, and this gave off just enough illumination to permit him to be able to navigate his way about in the bedroom's semi-darkness without having to turn on a light which might disturb her. He didn't want to turn on the overhead light, since it was possible that because his wife had not been feeling well, she simply had forgotten the routine and went to sleep. If this were the case, he really didn't want to risk waking her. Slowly, like a blind person, and trying to recall the layout of the room, he went deeper into the darkness with his hands extended before him. He felt around for a few pieces of familiar furniture that would allow him to orient himself in the room. Eventually, he worked his way over to the bathroom door, opened it, and reached in along the wall, searching for the switch. Finding it, he turned the switch, and a dim light began to shine in the bathroom. He fooled with the switch a bit more to increase the degree of illumination slightly, and turned around to see the bedroom behind him. The explosion caught him full force. There, on the bed, was his wife with another man, both fast asleep. His wife's arm was draped over the man's shoulder in an affectionate way. The husband inched closer to the bed, trying to determine the identity of the interloper. In order to better see the man, the husband took out his glasses, and after he had put them on and inched still closer to the bed, he was shocked to discover the man was his favorite servant. Anger shot up his spine like a hit of heroin and poured forth as if a volcanic eruption had taken place in his mind. He shook the sleeping man, yelling, "Get up, you ungrateful wretch, you worthless piece of human trash!" The man on the bed began to unwrap himself from the cocoon of sleep in which he had been enclosed, but the woman was instantly startled awake by her husband's yelling. Seeing that his wife was now awake, her husband pointed a finger shaking with outrage at her, but all he could manage was, "How could you? How could you do this to me?" And he began to cry as he slumped into a chair by the bed. His wife rushed over to him, put one arm on his shoulder, and used her other hand to try to pry his head upward so that she could look into his eyes. Her husband shook his shoulder, dislodging his wife's arm that had been resting there, and he resisted the pressure from his wife's hand on his jaw. His wife said, "It's not what you think, dear." She glanced over at the bed, and a look of perplexity washed across her face. She said, "I don't know why our servant is in the bed, but nothing improper has happened, I swear to you." The husband finally looked at her, his nostrils flaring and his eyes glaring. A smirk of disdain twisted his lips before he retorted with considerable sarcasm, "Isn't that what they all say? Oh, it's not what you think, dear," or "Baby, nothing happened," or "Honey, I know it looks bad, and I really can't explain it, but I swear to you I'm innocent." Sarcasm was replaced with its near cousin anger, and he continued on, "Do you really take me to be such a fool that I would come into my house and find my wife in bed with our servant with her arm draped around him, and believe that nothing went on between the two of you?" The spittle of outrage spewed from his mouth as he finished his charge in the form of a rhetorical question. By this time, the servant was fully awake. The man's eyes still registered residues of sleep, but more than anything, they expressed fear and confusion. The servant said, "I assure you, sir, nothing went on, nor has anything been going on between your wife and myself. Please," he implored, "let me tell you what happened, at least as much as I know." The husband turned his attention to the servant, and the former man replied, with contempt dripping from his every word, "Yeah, why don't you really tell me what happened? Your account might be the most entertainment I've had all day." And he turned away from the bed, cradling his head with his hands. The servant stuttered as he began to tell his story, while the husband stared blankly at the floor.
I come from poverty. I have been poor all my life." The man seemed to be desperately seeking for something more to say.
The servant was about to go on when the husband's head shot up and said, "Don't you dare try to use your impoverished upbringing as an excuse for immorality. I pay you good money. It's not my problem that you don't know how to make that paycheck grow through proper investments."
The servant shook his head back and forth and said several times, "No, that's not it. That's not it." He struggled to find the right words. "I just wanted to give you a sort of reference point so you might understand what and how I was thinking."
The husband waved his hand at the servant in a dismissive way and went back to inspecting the floor. He sighed deeply. The servant continued on,
"I had just finished my duties for the day. It was early evening. The light of day was beginning to fade, and I was both tired and feeling sorry for myself. I came upstairs to put some fresh towels in the bedroom, and after I did that, I walked past the bed and thought, 'What a beautiful, elegant, expensive bed with its satin sheets and space-age spring technology and its ornate headboard. The bed must cost thousands and thousands of dollars, and I will never sleep in such a bed.' I thought to myself, why not lie down and see what real Luxley feels like, just for a few minutes? Since the mistress of the house was occupied with some guests downstairs, I felt like taking this possibly unique opportunity to sample something of a rich man's life, and consequently I lay down and pulled the sheets over me. But instead of just resting for a few minutes, I fell sound asleep, and that's all I remember until you woke me up. The husband looked over at the servant and gave him a quick once-over. The man was, in fact, dressed in his usual servant's attire, but maybe the servant had dressed after his little tête-à-tête with his wife, and then had fallen back to sleep. The husband shrugged his shoulders and said, your story is plausible, but what you say could easily be countered by other possibilities, which also are consistent with the available evidence. He turned to his wife and said, so what's your spin on things? Disappointment appeared on her face. I don't have a spin on things, she said defensively, apparently a little too defensively for the husband's liking, and a certain weariness crept into his expression. She tried to block out her husband's aura of accusation and proceeded to her account of events. She began with, as you know, I wasn't feeling well. After some friends left, I fell asleep on the couch downstairs, probably one of the effects of the medicine I am taking. I awoke about an hour later, kind of groggy, and decided to go to bed properly. I stumbled upstairs, and since the room was dark and the door was open, I assumed you already had gone to bed, but had been too tired to turn on the bathroom light. So I closed the bedroom door, undressed in the dark, and put on my pajamas that were draped over the chair by my side of the bed. I left the light off because I didn't want to disturb you. When I got into bed, I thought the body already there was yours, and so I draped my arm over the shoulder of the man who was lying there, which in the present case turned out to be our servant. As she finished her account, she moved her shoulders and arms in a way which seemed to indicate, you see, there's nothing to it. The husband looked back and forth between his wife and the servant. On the surface, their stories appeared to corroborate one another, and everything seemed innocent enough, but still, there were some nagging doubts that were worrying about within him. Many of his friends were experiencing problems of infidelity. It was like an epidemic, and his wife was friends with many of the people who were playing musical beds. Furthermore, he never liked the way his wife always had been warm and friendly with the servants. Far too warm and friendly at times, he felt. Not only did he consider it improper, but her friendliness with the servants, especially the male ones, had been causing talk at the club. He often was away from home on business. She had complained just last week about how lonely she was. Maybe he even was to blame for putting temptation in his wife's way. Then there was the servant. The husband always had liked the man because of the servant's great flair for humor, but he also was young, charming, handsome, and Latino, and everyone knew about the hot, passionate blood which ran through their veins. In addition, one of his friends had been trying to give him the heads up a few days ago concerning this very same man. His friend had heard certain amorous rumors about this guy, and claimed the servant enjoyed a considerable reputation as a ladies' man around town, and apparently, on more than one occasion, the servant had violent encounters with aggrieved husbands. He looked over at his wife. She had been a good wife, but he knew that although she cared for him, she didn't really love him. The union had been more of a corporate merger than a marriage. In strictest confidentiality, a friend of his wife once had disclosed to him the story of a passionate romance from his wife's youth. She had fallen in love with a boy from the wrong side of the tracks, a Latino kid, it seems, and her parents had put an abrupt end to the relationship. According to his wife's friend, she never quite recovered from that romance. Indeed, there always had been a subtle sense of sadness about her for as long as he had known her. He suddenly remembered his wife once had said that this servant, the one who was sitting on the bed, the one with whom she often was so friendly, reminded her of someone she once knew. He recalled, quite vividly, that there had been a strong current of melancholy in her voice when his wife had told him this, and how, at the time, he had found the presence of that current somewhat strangely disquieting. The husband was caught between, on the one hand, the available evidence, that is, the stories of his wife and the servant, and on the other hand, his doubts. He had a decision to make. Should he have faith in the accounts of his wife and the servant, or should he be swayed by all the doubts, anxieties, and concerns which had arisen within him as he added pieces to the puzzle based on other information and experiences that were in his memory banks and on which he could draw and try and derive at a judgment on the situation? Was his wife innocent of any wrongdoing, just as she and the servant had said, or were they having an affair? He could build a plausible case for either possibility. Were his many doubts and anxieties concerning his wife and the servant a poison, and his faith in each of them the antidote? Or was it the other way around? Much of spiritual life revolves around these same kinds of questions. The following musical interlude is called Wonderful World. From the outback of Australia to the rainforests of South America, from the frozen tundra of Siberia to the plains of Serengeti, from the Himalayas of Asia to the white cliffs of Dover, from the geysers of Yosemite to the glaciers of Antarctica, you are listening to the Sufi Reverberations podcast. This week's meditative essay is titled Expectations. Harboring expectations can be a major source of difficulty. This is true both for people who are considering initiation, as well as for those who already have stepped onto the path. These expectations generally can be subsumed under roughly five categories. More specifically, one can have expectations in relation to 1. God, 2. The spiritual teacher, 3. The nature of the mystical path, 4. The conduct and character of other people on the path, and 5. Oneself. One of the problems most of us have in one form or another is we try to stuff God into our theories and conceptual frameworks. On the basis of these perspectives, we develop a series of expectations about what God should be and how God should be. Furthermore, we often set trials and tests which God is expected to ace if divinity is to pass muster. For example, we may say to ourselves, if God is to be a God worthy of our praise and worship, then God must do this or that, and thereby meet our expectations of how God should act. Alternatively, we may think to ourselves, if God wants our spiritual business, then God must be able to satisfy our carefully prepared 15-point diagnostic checklist. We then proceed to try to hoist God up on the examination table and check for weaknesses, defects, and warning signs. Different people draw up different kinds of diagnostic checklists to run God through. However, all of these lists are rooted in expectations we have of how God should be. We believe, for instance, that God must be good, or God must be a loving God, or God must be just. In addition, we have our own incompletely worked out and often inconsistent theories of goodness, love, and justice. We then proceed to set up expectations which require God to conform to the structural requirements and values embedded in our thinking. Rarely do we stop and seek to discover what goodness or love or justice mean to God. Rarely do we ask ourselves what, if anything, justifies our theories of goodness, love, or justice. Our opinions and beliefs are not justified just because we hold them to be so. Where is the reality check in all of this? From the perspective of Sufi masters, we distance ourselves from God in direct proportion to the weight of the baggage of expectations we try to impose on God. Indeed, expectations are one of the ways through which veils of ignorance and darkness are generated on the path. Furthermore, Sufi masters suggest we have the cart before the horse in this matter of expectation. If we wish to realize what can be expected from God, then first come to know God as God and not as a function of our theories about God. Let us open ourselves up to the reality of God and let God show us the errors in our various expectations. People also can have strange sorts of expectations about a spiritual teacher. Upon meeting a guide, we often expect a spiritual version of fireworks, or a dazzling ethereal floor show, or a display of beautiful otherworldly lights and auras to be radiating from the countenance of the sheikh, or breathtaking discourses which probe into the inner sanctum of metaphysical truths. If we don't experience these, we are disappointed. Our expectations have been violated. We begin to have doubts about the authenticity of the teacher. After all, if this person were truly a spiritual guide, then surely this individual would be this way or that way. The irony of the situation is this. All of the things we, however unfairly and unjustifiably, may expect concerning the nature of a spiritual teacher could be occurring before our eyes, ears, and minds, but we are too blind and ignorant to grasp the reality of what is in front of us. God is not under any obligation to disclose spiritual secrets to every Tom, Dick, and Mary who comes along. Similarly, spiritual guides are under no compulsion to share their secrets either. In addition, we are being presumptuous to suppose our condition is sufficiently worthy to be permitted access to such realities, although sometimes even when we are not worthy of such participation, spiritual generosity comes to our rescue. In any event, the absence of perceived mystical quote-unquote signs in the being or demeanor of someone who may or may not be a genuine spiritual teacher is neither here nor there. A person could be an authentic teacher, and yet we might not sense anything quote-unquote special about that person. At the same time, the absence of visible marks of grace does not necessarily permit us to conclude the individual is a genuine teacher who is merely veiling herself or himself from others. The fact of the matter is, if we really knew what was what, spiritually speaking, we wouldn't be in the predicament of having to find a teacher. In the meantime, we tend to thrash around in the dense jungle of our expectation of things. In concert with the foregoing kind of expectations, there is a tendency on the part of many people to confuse the purely human side of a teacher with the spiritual side of a teacher. For example, we may meet someone who is, let us assume, a genuine teacher. Perhaps we see this person eating and we think to ourselves, gee, this person eats more than a guide should eat, or the way the teacher eats somehow doesn't sit right with our expectations of how a spiritual person ought to eat, whatever way that is. Maybe the guide watches television or goes to movies. Again, this may jar our spiritual sensibilities. Maybe the teacher has interests or activities which are inconsistent with our expectations concerning the nature of a sheikh. Maybe the guide does not exhibit as much patience, tolerance, laughter, and so on as we feel is appropriate or in the way we deem to be proper. Without in any way wishing to maintain that a spiritual guide has license to do anything and everything he or she pleases, and without wishing to say there are no constraints of propriety within which a teacher is bound to operate, nonetheless, there are degrees of freedom available to a teacher. Through these permissible degrees of freedom, the teacher can give expression to the purely human side without compromising the spiritual side of things. The friends of God come in many shapes, sizes, colors, temperaments, and capacities. They are not all the same, nor do they need to be. The operative words in the above are, quote, friends of God, end of quote. A friend of God makes sincere, heartfelt efforts not to do anything on the human side which might undermine or adversely affect the spiritual side. God, on the other hand, permits friends to have some discretion in how they conduct their human lives. However, sometimes even friends make mistakes. When this is brought to their attention by the friend, they repent and seek God's forgiveness. Most of us are not in any position to sort out possible spiritual mistakes of the friends of God from the degrees of latitude which God has permitted to those same friends. To be sure, one ought not to abandon one's capacity for critical reflection in relation to such issues. Nevertheless, one is entering very dangerous and tricky territory when one establishes a set of expectations to which the teacher must conform in order to be a judged and authentic teacher. Almost everyone who is contemplating stepping onto the mystical path, or who already has done so, has many expectations about the nature of the spiritual path. For instance, one may have expectations about how easy or difficult the mystical journey is going to be. One also may have expectations about what one will receive from pursuing the path, such as mystical powers, spiritual gifts, visions, insights, goals, and so on. In addition, one may have expectations about how and when and where and why mystical experiences take place. One reads or hears about some of the mystical experiences of others. As a result, one builds up expectations concerning the arrival of such experiences in one's own case. Sufi masters point out there are a number of things one can do to help make the spiritual journey go more easily and more quickly. One of these beneficial actions is to throw overboard, without a life preserver, one's expectations about the nature of the Sufi path. The sooner one does this, the better off one will be. Every spiritual journey is unique because everyone's relationship with God is unique. While there are shared themes and concerns from one journey to the next, One should just let the path unfold of its own accord and in its own way. If we look after our responsibilities, the path will look after its responsibilities. Expectations only delay and complicate matters. In addition to our expectations concerning God, the spiritual teacher, and the nature of the mystical path, we also frequently tend to have expectations with respect to other people, both those on as well as those outside of the Sufi journey. For instance, we may have expectations about how they ought to or will behave, or what they will and will not understand. We also may have expectations about their interests, commitments, and values. Alternatively, we may have expectations about what their lifestyle is like and so on. Quite often, people who are not on a mystical journey, at least in any discernible sense, will surprise one with the depth of their understanding about spiritual matters. This surprise is the result of an expectation concerning such people. One could run into people outside of the path who may exhibit a variety of spiritual qualities, commitments, and interests that one might have thought would only be found by someone who had taken initiation with a spiritual teacher. The unexpected dimension of such an encounter is, once again, the sign of an expectation which is being rebuffed. On the other hand, one may meet with people who may have become initiated into a mystical tradition, and yet they don't seem to understand anything of a spiritual nature. Moreover, such people may not be leading the sort of lifestyle one thought would be second nature to a wayfarer of the mystical path. Here, too, expectations are being exposed. According to the Sufi masters, the best policy is not to have any expectations at all, either with respect to people on or outside of the mystical path. If one does this, one will never be disappointed, and more often than not, one will be able to appreciate people on their own terms. We all have spiritual potential. We all have spiritual problems. We all have our strengths and weaknesses. We all have dimensions we hold in common, and we all have our unique qualities. Sufi masters suggest we should not meet others with expectations. Instead, we should meet them with friendship. Finally, we all carry expectations concerning ourselves in relationship to the mystical path. Some of these expectations are rooted in low self-esteem. Others of these expectations are embedded in high self-esteem. The masters of the Sufi path suggest we dispense with both kinds of expectations. The practitioners of the Sufi path indicate that if we get rid of these kinds of expectations, then God willing, will we become receptive to truths about our essential self, which will put to shame both our sense of low self-esteem as well as our feelings of high self-esteem. You have been listening to the Sufi Reverberations podcast. I hope you will join me next week for a new episode of this program. May peace be your companion.